WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is magician and escape artist James Randi, who performs under the name The Amazing Randi. As a stunt, he's escaped from 28 prisons. He's also freed himself from a straitjacket while hanging upside down over Niagara Falls. In the tradition of Harry Houdini, Randi has also dedicated himself to investigating claims of supernatural and psychic powers. He's a founding member of the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, and last year he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship to continue this work. His new book is an expose of faith healers. It's published by Prometheus Books. I spoke with James Randi earlier this year. I asked him if there was a particular person or act that started him on his mission of debunking claims of supernatural powers.
When I was 15, I was only a developing conjurer, and a friend of mine up in Canada said, "Hey, you should see this guy working at the Spirit Church. He's got quite an act going." I said, "Really, what's that all about?" And he took me to a spiritualist church that Sunday. And I saw a man up there who was saying that God was revealing various things to him from sealed envelopes that people had handed in at the beginning of the service. And both of us knew right away what the gimmick was. It was a gimmick called the one-ahead gimmick, and we'd read about it and hadn't used it because it wasn't our line of work, but we knew about it.
I don't know about it. What's the one-ahead gimmick?
Well, the one-ahead gimmick consists of having the people who enter the church fill out usually an index card or a piece of paper and then sealing with a question on it. You're told at the door, put your full name on the outside of the envelope, and then write in it a statement of a factual nature, something that we can relate to into the spiritual world, you see. And then you're told to seal up that envelope and drop it in the basket. Then that basket is taken up to the front during the service, and the spiritualist stands there, takes an envelope, a sealed up envelope from the basket, holds it up to his or her forehead, and says, but before doing so, looks at the envelope and says, M.M., who is M.M.? And first of all, I'm sorry, to go back, he says, now you were told to put your initials on these envelopes and to write inside a question to which you need an answer. Now, that's not what you were told at the back. You were told to write a definitive statement. You're also told to put your full name on it. But each and every person in that church gets the impression, oh, I did the wrong thing. Everyone else wrote their initials. And, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to ask a question. I made a statement. Well, oh, what the heck. And when they hear the fellow up there saying, who is M.M., and looking over the audience, and M.M. holds up his or her hand, they assume, oh, that's what's written on the outside of the envelope. And he even flashes the envelope to you, though you can't see from where you're seated, that the whole name is written there. Marilyn Monroe or something might be written on it, for example. So the spiritualist holds this up to his forehead and says, God tells me, or the spirits tell me, or whatever, that the question you're asking is, and I'll give you a good example, oh, ma'am, as you do this, I get a flash of red, white, and blue. It's a big, bright flash of red, white, and blue, as if it's written on a piece of paper or a piece of cloth. Yes, it's a flag. It's a flag. It's red, white, and blue, and it's flashing this way. On one side, it's a stars and stripes. On the other side, this was done in Canada, remember. On the other side, it's a Union Jack. It's going back and forth from stars and stripes, Union Jack, stars and stripes, Union Jack. What was your question? It involves F. It involves F. I don't know whether that's a name or what it is. And the woman stood up in tears and said, yes, we're considering whether or not we should move to Florida in the United States. Now, what was actually written when we got the card afterwards was the woman's full name on the outside. He called her by name halfway through and said, Marilyn, is that the name I'm hearing? Marilyn? As if that's a name he's hearing, you see, not that he read from the envelope. And she says, yes, yes, I'm Marilyn. And everyone goes, ooh, you see, how did he know that? And then what was actually written on that card was, we're thinking of moving to the United States. Will it be a smart move? It's Florida. That's what was written on the inside. But the impression he gives is that he's getting this flag going back. It's dressed up. It's show business, and that's what it was all about.
Gee, well, now I know the origins of the Amazing Karnak. I never realized that that's probably what it's based on.
That's exactly based on that act, yes. Now, what happened at that time, I must tell you, is I went to three or four of these services. On the last one that I went to, I got very angry because I saw people there weeping real tears and getting very emotionally disturbed and believing that this man had supernatural powers. So I stood up and I tried to interrupt the service. I went to the waste paper basket he had at the side, snatched from it the last card that had gone in, and showed the person who was now being answered that her card was already in the basket, because you understand what they do now. This is how the one ahead works. The envelope that he's got to his forehead doesn't have M.M. or Marilyn Monroe or anything written on it. It has something else entirely different on it. It may have A.B. written on it for Abel Baker, whatever. But he's already read one, and that's why it's called One Ahead, and he knows what the question is on the inside and what the name is on the outside. He picks up an envelope, holds it to his forehead, and then holds it to his forehead through the whole thing and waves it around his hand, and then he says, let's check that, and opens the envelope.
Oh.
Now, he puts it aside and says, yes, that's correct, throws it in the wastepaper basket and says, now, picks up another one, and he says, A.B., looking at the front of it. Who is A.B.? And that's the one he's just read and thrown away. He's got a dummy in his hand that he knows nothing about. That's why it's called One Ahead. He's always one ahead on it, you see. So we knew that, and I held up the envelope and the card for the woman and said, look, here's your card. It's already in the basket. He just finished reading it. He's not developing it for what he's got in his hand.
You interrupted his act to do this?
And what happened was a policeman came in the back door. The police station was right across the street. His wife had called for the police. I was arrested and charged with disturbing a religious meeting. And at that point, I had to sit there for 4 hours as a 15-year-old kid in the police station waiting for my dad to come down and get me and promise that I wouldn't do it again. And that 4 hours was the worst 4 hours that the psychic world, in quotes, ever spent. Though they didn't know it until years later, because I made up my mind during that 4 hours that there would come a day when I would have the prestige, the knowledge, the platform on which to stand to denounce these people if they were fakes after a proper investigation. And that time arrived some years ago. That's what really started me on the thing.
James Randi, the amazing Randi, is my guest. He's a performer, a magician, and a conjurer, and escape artist. And he also spends a lot of time investigating claims to psychic powers. And he offers a $10,000 reward for anyone who can actually prove that they have them. And in the 20 years he's offered this award, he hasn't had to pay up to anybody.
I might add something to that, if I may.
Excuse me.
People will tell you, that is, the psychics will say, oh, but he makes up the rules. Oh, he is the only judge on the thing. Oh, he's very unfair. And all of that is just simply not true. Because if someone agrees to be tested by me, depending on what the claim is, it may be a claim that can be determined within 3 minutes. It may be something that takes 2 weeks, depending on what their claim is. They design the test, but I must agree that it is a fair test.
Do you ever get told that your negative vibes are having a bad effect on a psychic's
power? Yes, that happened
powers?
With an Alan Vaughn. Alan Vaughn determined that for Omni magazine he was going to prove that he was a psychic, the test was a very simple thing with 10 containers and a ball bearing sealed in one of them by random means, and he was supposed to identify it. Well, he did the test with me 3 times. I said, we'll keep doing it until you're satisfied that you can't do it. And it has to be done a certain number of times. And again, I won't get into all the details, but he did it in the offices of Omni magazine, and I was there, and he failed utterly. And then he said, oh, it's because Randi was so close because he puts out negative vibrations. I said, great. Next time we do it, we'll do it without me here. And we did it the following day, and what we did was, frankly, I got into a taxi cab, and Omni paid the bill, and they drove me to New Jersey, into another state. And then I called up the Omni people and said, okay, I'm over in New Jersey, in Teaneck, New Jersey. Go, you see, so my vibrations wouldn't interfere with it. But then he said, well, vibrations work not according to the law of inverse squares. As long as he knows the test's going on, then, of course, he could send out the vibrations over any distance. It doesn't obey the ordinary laws of physics. I said, whoops, well, we got it again. Well, then I fooled him. I was on my way back from Australia, and I called the San Francisco Examiner. I was stopping over for a couple of days, and I said, look, this guy wants to do the test. You do the test sometime in the next 48 hours, but don't tell me when it's taking place so I can't put out any negative vibrations, okay? And he said, yeah, we'll do that. And this time, Vaughn failed even worse than he had failed in the other. He didn't even get a chance on guessing which one of the cans it was in. And then he was told that I had instigated the test and that I'd designed the whole thing and everything and that it was the third test and now he had really failed. And he said, well, even if he doesn't know, now that he knows, these things can work backwards in time by reverse causality. And, of course, if they have excuses like this all the time, then how can they ever demonstrate their wonderful magical powers?
I have read, and you can tell me what you know about this, that the CIA and the KGB are both conducting very serious experiments examining psychic powers and how those powers could be used for spying or for warfare or whatever.
Yeah.
Is there truth to that, and what do you think of it?
You've got to go to the structure of the whole system, first of all. You've got to understand that if there is any chance, no matter how astronomically small, that psychic powers really do exist, then we have to know about them. If they did exist, it could be that the Soviet powers might have some sort of control over it. They might be able to use it. If it's only the tiniest fraction of 1% advantage over zero, then it's got to be known about, because that kind of advantage can make the difference between winning and losing. Therefore, the CIA and other government agencies and ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Department of Defense in Washington, has investigated these things. But luckily, the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, of which I'm one of the founders, that puts out the journal Skeptical Inquirer, is now being consulted by Department of Defense people in advance of them spending any money or making up any budget or actually involving themselves in research on the paranormal. And in most cases, I must say that we've been successful in showing them that there is no basis for conducting these experiments, and therefore they've saved their money.
When the CIA asks you whether a certain claim is worth investigating, are you going to tell them the magician's knowledge of it, or will you keep that part a secret from the CIA also?
I would be quite frank with them. I wouldn't keep anything from them, because I trust that they're not going to reveal the secrets of the trade, of the conjuring trade.
So maybe that's the one time you'd violate the magician's
absolutely.
Code.
Absolutely. No, there are times when we do that. For example, in doing psychic surgery, I have revealed actually on national television several times what the gimmick is. And actually, it's a gimmick that is used by some magicians to great effect. But the magician could come on television immediately following that performance, do a trick that involves this particular gimmick, and it would never dawn on you that that's what was used to do it. So I don't feel guilty at all in doing that. And frankly, if it's worth somebody's life, then it's very much worthwhile, and it has to be done. And the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians, I have received letters from their presidents and their ethics boards saying that they agree that what I have done in that line is quite ethical and well within their boundaries.
Let's go back in your life to when you first started learning magic. You were telling us a little bit about it before. Mm-hmm. Who was the first magician that you saw?
You tend to say musician.
Yeah,
everyone does. Yeah. Even I do occasionally. Well, it was Harry Blackstone.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you the experience of sitting in the Royal Alexandra Theatre in Toronto, Canada. Actually, playing hooky from school Wednesday afternoon matinee, the only one I could afford, and seeing that man down on the stage, this sort of elf, white-haired elf, and a man of mystery. He actually made that lady float in the air, and he passed a hoop around her in the air. And I said to myself at the time, hey, it's got to be mass hypnosis, or there's something wrong with me, I'm stupid or something. Or I guess it's a trick, it's a carefully designed trick. And I opted for the latter one, being a relatively rational person, and went backstage to meet him, and he was very gracious to me, signed an autograph, photograph for me, and I walked away. I still have that photograph. After all those years, it's a little tattered now, but I still have it. And that impressed me enormously.
What was the next step? Did you try to talk to him some more? Did you go to the local magician's shop?
Well, I had purchased a small book that was on sale in the lobby. It was on doing card tricks, and I discovered, hey, card tricks are marvelous. You can do this, that, and the other thing with them. Also, I discovered at the same time that there were other books available. I went to the library and took out A. Collins' book of magic for boys. I remember it was in English. Publication. It had wonderful stuff in it, with glasses of water and silk handkerchiefs and things like that. And I began to learn it. Then I found out there was a kid lived 3 or 4 blocks away who was also interested in it. I got together with him. Then he told me there was a shop that sold magic tricks right in Toronto, Canada, where I was born and raised. And I went down there, and it grows from there.
Now, I think before you graduated from high school, you left home to join a carnival as a magician,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, I...
Did you come from the kind of middle-class family that did not regard this with great pleasure?
My father wanted me to go into the telephone company where he worked all of his life, and my mother wanted, you know, the doctor, lawyer, something or other, something professional, maybe a scientist, because I was very much inclined to science at that age. But no, I decided that I wanted to do this, and they were scandalized. It took my father until I was about 30, 35 years of age, until he finally broke down and agreed to call me by my name, James Randi, which is not my born name. The other one is Austrian and Danish and very difficult. And he actually wrote me and asked for an autograph photograph to be given to somebody in his office. And it took him all that time to break down. It took so many years, I thought to myself, the old man's never going to come around. He's never going to admit that this is actually going to make me a living. But it did. It's done rather handsomely for me, I must say.
When you first started touring with the carnival, did anybody take you under their wing? You were still pretty young.
Yeah, they did. So many people took me under their wings down over the years. I had a very serious accident at the age of 18. I was struck by a car and had my back broken in two places, and I was in a body cast and never supposed to walk again. Since then, I've been hanging over Niagara Falls in a straitjacket and over the city of Tokyo a year and a half ago for the last time that I will ever do the upside-down straitjacket stunt, because I'm 58 years of age now, and it doesn't look comfortable for the audience to see a 58-year-old white-haired man hanging in a straitjacket. They get uncomfortable, and I don't want to make them uncomfortable. I can still do it as well as I ever did, if not better, but it's not the kind of thing for me to be doing at my age. I think perhaps the dignity has something to do with it, too. You look like a great dead tuna hanging by your ankles there. But for a man who broke his back at the age 18, I was doing all right. And I had a very hard time of it in those days. I depended a lot on the kindness of friends and total strangers who would do wonderful things for me. And I've always felt my obligation to help young people in the business particularly, and I do that a great deal.
My guest is the amazing Randy, James Randy. He's a magician and escape artist who also exposes false claims of paranormal powers. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air. James Randy, the amazing Randy, is my guest. So how did you start developing your specialties?
Well, the escape business came rather in a strange way. Houdini had done it in his day, and of course he was dead 2 years before I was born. So I never got a chance to see him work or learn anything about him. But the tradition certainly came down to me. I found out at a very early age that I could pick locks. I just learned what a pintover lock does, and I developed a set of tools, believe it or not, which turned out later when I saw professional lock-picking tools, almost exactly the same thing. I think I've got a set right in this briefcase here, which, if you'd like, I won't give lessons, but I'd be glad to show you what they look like. And I sort of forgot it at that point. About the age of 14, I discovered I could do that, and then I sort of left it aside. I had fun doing it occasionally to amaze people, but that was it. And I could certainly open up simpler locks. And then when I was 18, I was in the magic business by then. I was working in a nightclub in Quebec City, I'll never forget. And I was hanging around outside the nightclub in between shows, and a big detective policeman came by me, and the police car was sitting there, and he got into conversation with me, and he said in his inimitable French-Canadian way, he says, "You think I'll lock you up in these handcuffs here? You can take them off?" And I said, "Oh, I think so. That's a relatively simple lock." And he said, "Well, we'll try it here. Just give me your hands." And I said, "Oh, I've got a show to do right now." I was just sort of trying to get out of it because it would be a nuisance and might take me quite some time. And I said, "I've got a show to do, but I'll meet you right here after the show." And he said, "Okay, I'll be here. You can depend on that." So I went upstairs to do the show, and I frankly forgot all about it. I changed, took off the makeup, came downstairs, whistling Dixie, and I hit the street, and he clapped the handcuffs on me. And I said, "Oh, boy, I forgot all about that." And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, there's a bit of a weakness here. And I won't go into the technical details, but I said, "Can I get in the squad car?" And he said, "Sure, do you want?" Then he opened the door for me, and I got into the squad car and shuffled over on the seat and got out the other side with the handcuffs off. And that amazed him. So he had to drive me down to the police station to introduce me to his captain and to tell the captain all about it. They drove me down to the police station. When I saw that their cell was fastened with a very good quality padlock, but a simple padlock, I thought to myself, hey, I can open that kind of padlock. So I said, "Why don't you put me inside the cell?" And they did. And the next morning, the Quebec Le Soleil, the newspaper, came out with a headline, L'étonnant Randy s'évade de la prison de Québec. The amazing Randy, and I'd never used the word the amazing. I was the great Randy up until then. But the amazing Randy escapes from the jail of Quebec, or the Quebec jail. Well, it's the only newspaper clip I'd ever had. So I think I bought at least 400 copies of that newspaper. And I think I still have some at home if I looked under the bed. And it made me famous overnight. And when I came back to the club the next night, the manager met me at the door. He said, "Forget all the stuff with the rabbits and everything. They want to see you get out of handcuffs and things." And I said, "Oh, boy." And I developed a brand new act with rope ties and the straitjacket and everything, and got called to the States on the strength of it.
Did you ever get yourself into a situation you couldn't get out of?
Oh, you must understand, the magician doesn't do that. It's like doing a card trick. You start out, you don't tell them what you're going to do in advance. And as things develop, if you find that there's a hitch in or it didn't go the way you might have planned it, you simply change the method and the goal midstream. It's very much like throwing a dart at a dartboard, but what I do is I throw the dart, then I go and paint the dartboard around the target, out of the target, around the dart or the arrow, whatever you see. So when you're doing the escape, you do it essentially along those lines, too. Of course, the thing is you have to escape eventually. But you put yourself in such a position that you can regulate the thing. The magician, as a performer, is in control. He's got to be. He's got to be an authority figure, and he's got to be in control. The same way the psychics are. And Uri Geller, the psychic, proved that beyond any shadow of a doubt. He was always bullying the scientist. He told them, well, if you don't do it that way, I'm just quitting and going home. That's all. I want get me a taxi. I want to leave now. And they'd say, oh, no, Mr. Geller, don't leave. Oh, please, we'll do it your way. And, of course, they did it his way, and it worked.
With your background, you know, knowing how scams work and joining a carnival where you were exposed to a lot of scams, you could have gone that way yourself.
Oh, easily.
You could have passed yourself off as a psychic if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider doing that?
Yes. When I was a kid, I really started out doing mentalism and doing this sort of thing, and I got so much newspaper space. It was so easy to walk into a reporter's office who had a column to do that day and see him sitting in front of a typewriter saying, oh, boy, I had the transvestite fireman with the two heads yesterday. What do I do today, you know? And I can't top that, and the editor is banging on the window saying, where's your copy, and I haven't got it. And I would walk in and say, hey, I can do a miracle. You say, sit down. I want to talk to you. And they would write. They would print almost anything you told them. If you said you were a seventh son of a seventh son, it went into print immediately. The media has always been like that. Unfortunately in some ways, but certainly fortunately for someone starting in the business. And I had so much newspaper space because I did mentalism. It ended up with some people in the United States reading about me through the press services, and one gentleman showed up at my door at a rooming house in Toronto, Canada one day, and said, I'm prepared to pay you $500 a week if you will simply take a racing form and tell me where you get vibrations. And I said, but you don't understand. This is an act I do. It's not real. Oh, no. I've read what appeared in the paper. What you did could not have been done by trickery. I said, yes, it could. And he said, no. I'm an intelligent man. I have a PhD, and I know that that can't be done by trickery, and I know that you may not be able to come up with winners for me right off, but I'm prepared to pay you until you do come up with a winner that's big enough that it'll make me rich. And I just threw him out of the house, really annoyed at him. And I had to reflect. I had to say, hey, you either do it or you don't do it. You go ahead with it now, or you stop dead and you say, hey, I turned my back on this. And I had to, because I couldn't sleep. I mean, there's no way I could sleep swindling people. I'm an entertainer, pure and simple. That's what I do. And I always end up all of my performances and my lectures by saying, no, Virginia, I'm sorry. There really is no genuine Santa Claus. And any charlatan that tells you there is lying to you. I can't do real magic. I think there's more magic in perhaps in the opening of a morning glory than anything that I or any of the charlatan of history has ever done, is doing, or ever will do. And I leave you with that thought.
You know what I love in some of your publicity photographs? You're staring into the camera, kind of like Nostradamus.
Yes.
And you look like a visionary
or
a conjurer, someone who has powers beyond those of mortal men. How did you get that pose? Very theatrical.
Well, I only have two expressions. One is nothing, and the other is very theatrical. There's nothing in between, it seems. You come upon these things. I've had so many interviews and so many photographs and tapes and film shot and whatnot that you get onto that. I just follow an expression. I say, do you want the expression? They say, yeah. And I give them the expression. Click goes the camera. They walk away very happy. And the editor looks at it and says, wow, do a full page on it or whatever, you know. You're selling newspapers and you're selling space. You're selling advertising in the long run. And I can understand that. But I do say the media has almost have to take the entire blame for promoting this whole belief in the paranormal, because they so easily publicize psychics without investigating them at all.
You told us that you've retired from hanging upside down and yeah, getting out of straitjackets.
But not from magic.
I want to just ask you one thing about when you're doing the straitjacket bit over Niagara Falls or Tokyo or Madison Avenue. What do you think? I mean, are you thinking about anything? Are you thinking about how terrible it would be to fall into Niagara Falls, for instance?
Over Niagara Falls, I must say, I was thinking to myself, what are you doing, you fool?
Were you really?
If my mother knew what I was doing, she thinks I sell drugs, you know, and she'd be ashamed of me. No, I really, over Niagara Falls, it was so cold. It was 20 below zero.
Are you kidding?
It was. The ski mask that I had over my face actually froze to my beard from the moisture I was exhaling as I panted and grunted and groaned up there. And they had to actually pour hot water over the front of the ski mask because it was frozen solid in a lump of ice to my beard. They had seven cameras going. Two of them froze solid. The shutters froze and wouldn't work with a little bit of moisture that was in there. And they got great footage, though. Oh, they got great footage. It showed on HBO. In fact, it shows quite frequently on HBO. They keep it for a couple of years, and they show it again. And Xerox Corporation prepared a 30-minute film out of the whole thing. It was a heck of an experience. And while I was there, I'm saying, I want to get warm, and I want to go home. What am I doing? I'm an idiot. I could be out selling Tupperware. I could be selling aluminum siding from door to door. What am I doing? And then, of course, when the thing's over and you hit the ground and the people start to cheer, you say to yourself, wait a minute, I wouldn't do anything else for a living. That, there's something about applause and people's laughter that is so hypnotic and so habit-forming. So totally captivating once you've heard it and experienced it and know that you did something that pleased them and they're standing up and looking at you and laughing and smiling and applauding you, you say, wow, nothing will compare with this. And I swear there is nothing that can compare with it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's
really
been
terrific. Thanks for being here. My guest has been James Randi. He's a magician and an escape artist, and he's also dedicated himself to debunking false claims of psychic powers. His new book, The Faith Healers, is published by Prometheus Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.